Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini-episode number 644. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. We have a great conversation coming up for you today, and something that is really kind of unique in the annals of the program. On the show where nothing is off-topic and where we strive to have the widest possible conversational range of any show out there, it's always humbling to contemplate areas that we haven't gotten into as much. And previously, health and medicine is something that we've not gotten a chance to cover a whole lot, but we're looking forward to changing that. We're starting today by featuring a conversation with a very learned gentleman in the areas of orthopedic surgery and sports medicine, Dr. Kenneth Aline in the New York area. You can find information about him at EOSM.net. That is Eastern Orthopedic Sports Medicine. He is Assistant Clinical Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, previously residency training at Howard University Hospital, Sports Medicine Fellowship at Yale, Research Fellow at Harvard MIT Division of Health Sciences and Technology, a gentleman who is well-versed in many different areas of the physical anatomy. In particular, I know that he is a specialist in the areas of the shoulder and the knee. So we're going to talk a little bit of a macro level with him as far as things that people should know about sports medicine that we could all be concerned with out there, a little bit of micro level. It's been much in the news this fall with the NFL, some of the big surgeries and injuries that have been suffered on the gridiron. We'll talk about all that and much, much more, as I say, with Dr. Kenneth Aline, and it's a pleasure to welcome to the show. Dr. Aline, thank you so much for being here today. How are you, sir?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm well. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you on. I've been looking forward to the chance to get to talk to you about some of these issues. And know that, again, it's really been on the lips of a lot of folks this fall, of course, with the NFL being the highest profile league in America, and with the explosion of interest in recent decades in fantasy football, and more so in recent years, daily fantasy football. And people are concerned with how players on their favorite teams, both the virtual and their actual favorite teams, are doing. You have these injuries like plantar fasciitis for Peyton Manning this fall. So there's a tendency among the public a lot of times to kind of act as though we're in this kind of wave of these things happening. These guys are breaking down, these high-profile, high-dollar athletes, more than they used to. In a macro sense, that kind of seems true if you're talking about, say, the 1950s and the 1960s. We didn't hear as much about exotic injuries at that time. But relative to where we've been in recent years, do you sense that this is kind of a trend of more breakdowns out there? Or is that just sort of the sense that the public has because we're in a cyclical part here of the landscape where it seems like a lot of these famous guys are breaking down at once?
Well, you know, it's an excellent question. I think it's a combination. Certainly, the players in the 50s, a lot of them played hurt, probably more hurt than they should have back in the 50s and 60s. There were a lot of things done to keep players on the field back then that we certainly wouldn't do now. And the risk and the downside and the economic implications are much greater now than they were then. So you kind of have that historic perspective. For instance, in my practice, I see a lot of patients who have severe arthritis in the knees. Well, to ask a patient from the greatest generation to have a knee replacement at 65 or 70, you know, they want to look at you like you're crazy. What else you got, doc? I can hobble around. I'm great. Versus I'll have a 50-year-old young executive who's looking at retirement in 10 years and still wants to be able to play 18 holes in the golf and says, my knee's killing me. Give me a new knee, whatever it takes. So some of it's been a frame shift as to how we see injury and experience injury. On the other side, you know, we're faster, bigger, and stronger than we ever were as athletes. And so there's the question of what does that mean in terms of how we train, what we put in our body, how we treat injury. You know, a lot of what you see now, there's been some sense that the collective bargaining agreement that was signed, I think, about 3 years ago in the NFL, which shortened the amount of preseason time that athletes had working out as a team, may also be affecting these injuries. And, you know, when you look at a lot of these players, remember, you know, a lot of the big names that we're seeing now are well into their 30s, and so they've actually beat the odds by many measures in regards to NFL injuries. So I think it's a combination of we're stronger, we're faster, we're working out more intently. A lot of the kids now that we're seeing and the athletes that we're seeing are, you know, were in programs when they were 5 and 6, and now the chickens have come home to roost versus when you really only started playing football in high school. So I think it's a multifactorial problem, and a lot of what you've indicated are pieces of that puzzle.
Very good points there, Doctor. And I know that specifically something that kind of rang true to me is when you were talking about further back over a period of time, people would kind of play through things a little bit more because of, I think, the general lack of knowledge that was out there relative to what we have today, and that old mentality of just rub a little dirt on it and get back in there. And perhaps there were some shortened careers that came from that, but I'm kind of struck because even though this isn't a sports medicine issue, I myself a couple months ago was diagnosed with celiac disease, and I find that that's something that older people have a hard time wrapping their heads around. Like, we didn't have that way back then, and maybe the best explanation that I've heard is somebody said, well, of course you had it back then. People died of it because we didn't know how to diagnose it. So in a less dire sense of mind, as regards players' careers, because that's not life and death, but isn't it something of the same kind of element there that back in the 50s, 60s, and not to single out those decades, but before then and perhaps even a little bit after then, we just didn't have the level of awareness of some of the things with the human anatomy that could go wrong, yes?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that was, you know, when, and we should talk about the 50s and 60s and even the early 70s. That was really before the advent of modern sports medicine. You know, I'm doing knee replacements now on patients who were athletes in the 70s, probably 4 or 5 years before the advent of the arthroscope, who underwent a procedure called total meniscectomy, where a little 2.5 incision would be made and they'd rip out your meniscus, because even as late as the 70s, they questioned whether the meniscus was even needed. Right. 10 years later, the arthroscope comes about, and there's more research, and we understand that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. And we try to preserve the meniscus and take as little of the meniscus being the shock absorber piece of cartilage that's inside the knee. So there's a lot of awareness that we didn't have, a lot of ability to diagnose that we didn't have previously. And, you know, one of the things that I see even in my children in the school, there's a much greater awareness of things about a autism spectrum and children with ADD. And certainly in the 50s and 60s, that wasn't something that you talked about. Those were the kids who may have been a little different or had some learning challenges. But medicine has allowed us to have a greater understanding of many, many, many things that have occurred over the last half century that just simply weren't able to be envisioned previously.
Absolutely, yes. ADHD is a perfect example of that, and there are others as well. And I'm kind of struck when you mentioned the 1970s there and having to do knee replacements, because one of the things I think about when I think of the 1970s transformatively in the sports world was the kind of explosion after the opening of, what was it, I think the Astrodome in 65. You start getting artificial turf everywhere, and something that in retrospect I think we can recognize as little more than painted green concrete. But how much of a suspicion do you have when you look at this? Because today, at least with field turf, you know, they're doing their darndest to mimic actual grass. There seems to be legitimate science to it these days. But what the guys used to play on back in the day, when you start looking at some of these knees, how much of a tendency is there on your part to attribute some of it to what they were getting hit or tackled on?
Oh, absolutely, particularly in the 70s and early 80s. I mean, you know, there are colleges that, you know, someone should write a book on the history of the fields, because the number of times that grass has gone in and come out, field and various forms of turf have gone in as the turfs have improved, and then the injuries change and the turfs come up and we go back to grass. I mean, it's just been amazing. Now I think the turfs are the best they've ever been, but certainly when you look at the athletes who played on, as you said, painted green concrete, the so-called carpet, exceedingly abusive on knees, very, very abusive on knees. And now that we see that there's a more of a, such a, certainly a greater tendency to play on natural surfaces or more natural-like surfaces and turf fields, it's much better.
Absolutely. I kind of wince whenever I see on ESPN Classic some of the fields that these guys played on and start to think about the toll on the human body. To an extent, I think for a lot of us out there, it kind of colors the way we look at it, much like you watch the old Ali fights and you watch the Rumble in the Jungle and that kind of stuff, and kind of a little bit less fun to watch when you think about him developing Parkinson's subsequently. So I don't know about you, Doctor, but that kind of colors the way I look at some of these old films here, these primitive circumstances that guys had. I mean, helmet technology has come a long way. I mean, you could say that we were doing the best we can with what we had at the time in terms of our level of knowledge, but the science in a lot of different areas just seems to have increased exponentially in the last couple of decades.
Oh, absolutely. The science and the awareness. You know, I wince when I look at some of these films. I was watching one with my son the other day. It was a Giants game in the 60s. I think it was 64. And a player was clearly knocked out in a play. Three plays later, he was back on the field. I mean,
wow.
And I spent a long time with my son, who was his first year playing organized football, just explaining to him why that was not a good thing. And if he has any concerns after being hit, that he should talk to the coach and certainly talk to the trainer and, of course, talk to his dad, that we don't allow players to do that anymore. So, you know, particularly in the last 40 to 50 years, our knowledge base has turned over multiple times in regard to the diagnosis and management of sports injury.
Absolutely. And when you're talking about anything above the shoulders there, I think the one time we did really get into some science and medicine previously on the program, we were fortunate enough to have on Christopher Nowinski and talk about some of the work that his institute is doing in regards to head injuries. And I remember this was a couple of years ago. It was still at that time a matter where it was still a little bit up in the air as far as banning shots to the head in the NHL. And I remember at the time of the conversation, that was still kind of a controversial topic, especially among the old-timers. I mean, this is one of these things where it does seem like, you know, especially in later decades, we're really going to look back and wonder how a lot of these practices were ever there in the first place.
Absolutely. You know, I can remember, I grew up in Connecticut in Hartford, and we had a team called the Hartford Whalers. And I remember there was a point where they grandfathered certain NHL players to not have to wear a helmet. So I remember seeing Gordie Howe play hockey without a helmet while the other players still had a helmet. It's just amazing what was allowed, and we just didn't know. Like you said, we did the best that we could with what we had, and I literally have seen patients who were 4 or 5 years away from a medical decision that would have changed completely the life of their knee or the life of their shoulder with the advance in medicine in that time frame.
That is amazing, and again, I certainly appreciate the reference to Gordie Howe. Big fan of Mr. Hockey, as I am a big fan of the Red Wings. So I appreciate you bringing that up, Doctor. And when you talk about tough old guys, I'm thinking again of Peyton Manning and everything that he has endured at this point. Looking at him from afar, just kind of trying to gauge here, people have been wondering this season how much appears to be coming from just the general physical breakdown that you get to in your late 30s to certain issues. Now we find out about the plantar fasciitis. I think last season he was having leg injuries late in the year that were kind of, if you listen to some of the experts, affecting his ability to kind of plant. So when you look at him, again, this is from afar, so I'm not asking for a specific diagnosis, but what's your sense generally of the mixture of a plantar fasciitis injury could really affect the ability to pass the ball in any kind of authoritative fashion and versus just looking at how much of this might just be overall general physical deterioration that you get after that many years of punishment?
Well, you know, I do think it's a combination of both. I would not underplay, if we really believe the plantar fascial diagnosis, I mean, I have not seen the MRI and I have to believe the team docs, and it's even beyond plantar fascia. They're calling it a partial plantar fascia tear, which is a very painful, very painful diagnosis. I've seen many patients with it, and you actually would rather it just tear altogether because the pain often goes away. His brother Eli Manning had the same thing but suffered a complete tear, and I don't think missed a game or maybe missed one game, but I'm fairly certain didn't miss any. So it's a very painful process. And in a leg-dominant thrower, which Peyton is, meaning he relies on the force of the follow-through from the hip, leg, and foot landing to throw the ball, it can make it quite difficult because you're landing quite gingerly trying to avoid the pain, and all of your biomechanics are off. And you know, he had four interceptions in one game. It may have been the worst game of his career before he got sat down. And a guy like Peyton Manning, obviously there's a lot of pride in his play. He's played a long time. I believe he's 36 years old. He's suffered multiple injuries. But I do believe this is a lot about having that pain and inability to be, you know, he's already compromised being 36 years old. You have a very narrow bell-shaped curve of the sorts of injuries that you can sustain and still be able to perform. A 22-year-old quarterback may have the same problem, but be able to kind of work around it just because of the physical and physicality and the athleticism at that age that you can't do at 36.
Absolutely. And you said something there that kind of makes me wonder a little bit, because I may be misremembering this a little bit, or perhaps it's the difference in playing at different positions. But thinking back to the 90s, if I remember correctly, I think Eric Retz suffered the plantar fascia tear in his foot, and that pretty much ended things for him. I don't know if I'm remembering that correctly or not, but is it a matter of where it might be a worse thing for a running back because of the amount of planning that you have to do on almost every play? Does it affect some players differently than others?
Yes.
What might account for the differences in how people respond to something like that?
Well, it is. It's, you know, a lineman who really just kind of has to stand and move primarily laterally or medially doesn't have the same stress on the foot as someone who's either planting to cut, like a running back or a wide receiver, or a quarterback who's landing hard on that foot to throw. So your ability to kind of manage with that is very position dependent, and the amount of compromise that the tissue is experiencing. Again, you know, ironically, for that particular tissue to tear completely is a much better situation than a partial tear. A similar injury that many of your listeners may have experienced is the so-called tennis elbow. The medical term is lateral epicondylitis. Often, that is a partial tear of the tendon at the elbow, and that partial tear is very, very painful, and we can do multiple injections and sometimes require surgery. Versus when patients exhibit a complete tear, there is a short time frame of pain, but often that pain will resolve and they're able to go on to resume their work activities or sports with very little discomfort. The partial tear that Peyton apparently has, I think, is a large part of what's bothering him. And if he were a center, I think it would be a very different outcome in terms of his ability to play.
I'm sure it would. That's a very, very interesting scenario for him. And, yes, unfortunate if a partial one would end up being worse and more painful than a full tear. But regardless, one way or another, he's not alone right now, because by the month of November in the NFL – there's nobody that's 100% at this point, unless, ironically, they're coming off the disabled list and haven't really gotten banged up yet, but that really doesn't happen for the most part at this part of the season. So in terms of nagging injuries, because I know there's a lot of people out there, whether it be making decisions for their own fantasy football team or what have you, as they're looking at this, there's a lot of guys that are marked probable who are going to go every week, but you don't quite know what you're going to get out of them, so when you're looking at the range of things here in terms of quadriceps injuries, hammies, whatever, what would be the things that you would be more concerned about as a fantasy football owner? Like, ooh, that guy's been fighting this for a while. That might not be so good.
Well, certainly at the top of the list are ligament injuries and broken bones in the lower extremity. You know, ligament injuries don't heal like other injuries. You know, we know that there are MCL injuries, you know, Le'Veon Bell, MCL, Ben Roethlisberger, MCL, those injuries can take a very long time to heal. Some ligament injuries, like the ACL, we know you're out for the season. That's pretty much done just by the nature of the surgery and the rehab that has to occur, particularly in a running position. There are linemen who have come back from ACL and been able to make it through the season to have the surgery after. But certainly ligament injuries would be the worst. Second are the bony injuries, the fractures. Dez Bryant, Edelman, the famous Jones fracture, named after Sir Robert Jones, who was an orthopedic surgeon in the early 20th century and was a dancer, and sustained this injury, which is a break in the bone at a critical area in the fifth metatarsal, which is the bone on the very outside of the foot, the long bone on the very outside of the foot. There's an area there where the blood supply is really poor. And so a fracture there has a very, very, very low likelihood to heal quickly. which is why the indication in my field, in the sports medicine field for professional athletes or college athletes or even high-end high school athletes is to operate immediately, whereas other fractures, we don't operate immediately. We'll wait for it to heal. That one, you operate immediately because we know that there's a high likelihood of developing what's called a non-union or a lack of union or fusion of the bone, which is why I think Edelman was in the OR the next day. Because days count, because that's one of the few injuries, as we see with Dez Bryant, where you actually could get back within a season. So the ligaments, I would say, are the worst, followed by the bones.
Interesting. There's another one, too, and ironically, this is not something we've really seen this year too much on an injury list with prominent players, but something that has been a factor a lot of times in recent years. Players getting turf toe, which that always struck me. Again, on the surface, that doesn't sound like much. I think Joe Sixpack kind of has the tendency to think that it's not anything really that serious necessarily, but I forget who. Somebody had said to me at one point and pointed out how vital the big toe is in terms of balancing, that you're going to have a hard time even balancing and being kind of level on your foot and being level in your posture if you've got an issue with your big toe. What's the story there?
Well, the story there is you're absolutely right. I mean, turf toe is kind of, it happens because the turf happens to be a very firm surface, a hard surface, and as you push off, the toe bends back naturally. Well, when you're pushing off on a hard surface, it creates more force on the ligaments around the toe, and those ligaments can become sprained chronically or even torn. Very painful. Can limit your ability to even have shoe wear. And again, for athletes who need to run, why we see it a lot in running backs often, and even linemen can have it as well, but any athlete who has to kind of push off on those toes can be tremendously painful and hampered by turf toe. But it's really a sprain of the ligaments, and unfortunately, ligament sprains are one of those things that you just kind of have to wait them out and play when you can play. We often don't operate for ligament sprains. You rest them. In many of these instances, we'll put the player or the athlete in a boot, allow them to bear weight on it, and when it's not painful and they feel they can go, they can return to athletics.
Absolutely. One of those ones that just seems to require a lot of patience during the healing process. I had a question that was put to me today. One of my coworkers with the show, Joe Lindway, is moving into orthopedic medicine himself, and there was something that he wanted me to ask you about, was the nature of injuries that come sometimes from a muscle imbalance in terms of a muscle in one area of the body might be a little bit stronger than its counterparts nearby and how that can kind of lead to injury sometimes. Talk
sure.
a little bit about that, please, and about how that can be an issue that cause, I think is not well understood. I certainly haven't heard anybody discuss that before.
Well, you hit on a very sore point for me. I ran track and played football in college, and I suffered the effects of muscle imbalance. Like many athletes back in the 80s when we had less of a knowledge about the need to train and balance muscles and muscle strength, a lot of what we did were very quadriceps dominant weights and activities, leaving the hamstrings to get whatever was left over at the end of a workout, and generally not as much time spent on the quad. Well, for someone who's a sprinter or any athlete where you have to have explosive sorts of speed and motion, that quad fires so strong, the ability for the hamstring, which is trying to work in the opposite direction to break the quad action and allow your leg or knee now to bend, it's disproportionately weak. And what do you get when that occurs? The hamstring injury.
Yep.
So muscle balance is really important. The other group of athletes where this was a big issue were cyclists. You'd see these cyclists, if you ever see when they come off the bike at the Tour de France or in the Olympics, with these massive quads and relatively much smaller hamstrings. In the last 10 to 15 years, that's changed significantly, and you'll see the cyclists, particularly in the Tour de France, those who are dominant through the mountains and the climbing phases are those who were able to pull. And pulling through is primarily a hamstring dominant aspect of your cycling stroke. So muscle imbalance is very, very – muscle balance is very, very important. The other place that we see this is in the shoulder. when I was in New Haven, we would take care of professional athletes. Pitchers would come to see us, and they've lost, their fastball or their curve isn't dropping the way they would like it. And we would exercise these folks and check their muscles, and you'd see in the rotator cuff, which is generally a balanced group of muscles, tremendous imbalance. And when you focus on correcting that imbalance, all of a sudden the speed comes back and the accuracy comes back without needing surgery. So muscle balance is tremendously important when we look at injuries.
And, you know, it's interesting because it was the quad and the hammy that my colleague Joe Wedway was speaking about specifically when he wanted me to ask you about that. So I regret hearing that it affected you so personally, but that's a very good story about what it means and how it can affect players. I have to ask you, too, and I'm going to keep this kind of general because I'm not looking to be sensationalist here, but the comments from Brady Quinn some weeks ago, which you may have heard about when he was speculating as far as some of the issues that players may be having with PEDs, and again, it's sort of been my assumption over a period of time with some of the designer drugs out there that without the blood and the hair testing, which most sports collective bargaining agreements prohibit, that there probably is still a decent amount of that stuff going on. So to whatever degree, when you look at this, and again, I'm not going to ask you to talk about any specific cases with players, but are there ever any times that you hear about injuries with some of these players and it kind of causes you to wonder a little bit because of the effects of how steroids or other drugs might work on the body?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You're right. We probably don't want to speculate about specific athletes, but there are certain injuries that we know, particularly some of the ligament and tendon injuries, go hand in hand with some of the performance-enhancing drugs, for certain. There are certain bony injuries. There are a couple athletes who recently were noted to have what's called avascular necrosis, meaning a death to part of the bone in the body. And we also know that various forms of steroids can do that. There was a very famous athlete maybe 15 years ago or so who had that and attempted to come back from that but wasn't able to do so effectively. These drugs are here. They're real. Unfortunately, I see them in high school athletes. We see them in college athletes, and certainly we see them in professional athletes. Despite all the headlines and the commentary that we see from the media and others, there's still a blind eye because you have to know in a sport like football, where strength is everything, how often in the course of a season do we actually hear about an athlete being suspended for performance-enhancing drugs relative to the 53-man rosters that are on these teams?
That's right. And when you look at the amount of weight gain and muscle gain that these players go through over a period of time, absolutely. I think it would be naive to just assume that everything that you see is occurring naturally. In that regard, in terms of things a little bit more general for the public, I have to tell you something that I have picked up on anecdotally and in talking to people, and as they start to get a little bit older, you start getting into shoulder injuries. I've known three different people that have had to have rotator cuff surgeries, and again, no real tipping point in any of the cases that seem to cause something like that, just kind of general deterioration. Of late, in talking to people, I've been getting a sense just kind of generally the notion of sleeping on one side and kind of putting all the weight on the shoulder, as it were, at a bare minimum, that doesn't feel like it's necessarily that good for the body. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, myself included, that seems to be the more natural position. But to what extent is there anything to that, that the notion of putting that much weight on your shoulder during sleep could be painful, or I'm sorry, could be damaging?
Well, I actually think it's the first thing you said, could be painful. Generally, the thought is that the problem has occurred, and so we're noticing it secondarily. So night pain is the hallmark of a rotator cuff problem. I don't know that there have been any studies or research to show that sleeping on that side is really the cause. Generally, it's the result. The pain is the result of the rotator cuff problem and now becomes notable while sleeping. You know, what's happened over the last bit of time, you know, particularly men and women are far more active than they were, than my parents' generation, for instance. So they're in the gym at an earlier age. You know, they're playing more golf, they're playing more tennis, they're involved in yoga and other sorts of active lifestyles. which put more stress on the rotator cuff. And you're absolutely right. I'm seeing far more. You know, there was a time when rotator cuff surgery was really something you saw in patients kind of north of 60. Now the amazing number of 40 and 50-somethings who dominate my practice in regards to rotator cuff tears and rotator cuff problems. So I wouldn't point the sleep to it. I would probably suggest that it is associated with other forms of activity and some of it being just genetic, and that the sleep tends to bring it out, and the sleep is often what brings patients in to see me to manage their rotator cuff problems.
In terms of for people that are having problems with that and where it's not yet at a point of surgery being necessary, to what extent is because I've been getting a much greater degree personally of knowledge in this and interest in it as I've been practicing it more myself. But in terms of swimming, in terms of the arm motions that are consistent with that, and I'm guessing in my case particularly the backstroke, since I do an awful lot of that, it seems, again, to me anecdotally as though it kind of helps my shoulders, but I don't know. Is that swimming? We hear a lot about the therapeutic properties of it and ways that it can help. Is it particularly good for the shoulders?
Well, swimming is my favorite sport to suggest to patients overall with injuries. I mean, it's a total body workout. You can get a lot of done in a short period of time. You can burn a tremendous number of calories and work almost all the muscles, joints, and tendons in the body. Ironically, swimming does put the rotator cuff in touch with the bone at the top of the shoulder, the acromion bone, that can often be a part of the problem. The benefit that you get from swimming is the strength that you're getting to that rotator cuff by increasing the strength, increasing the balance, allowing the ball and socket of the shoulder to work more efficiently. You can actually reduce the likelihood of rotator cuff problems, or ironically, improve the symptoms of a rotator cuff problem. One of the reasons that rotator cuff issues become symptomatic is that the ball and socket aren't moving smoothly. The shoulder has the largest range of motion of any joint in the body, and we depend on that motion to do a lot of things, particularly overhead sorts of activities. Well, ideally, you want that ball to roll more than glide, meaning more than slide up in the socket, if you can imagine a golf ball on a tee. By having a very strong shoulder, you allow that ball to roll more than slide. When it slides, it usually slides up. When it slides up, it causes the rotator cuff to get pinched by the bone, and ultimately that can lead to rotator cuff problems and a rotator cuff tear. So swimming, by strengthening that shoulder, you're helping your shoulder out tremendously.
Well, that's good to know for me personally and for anybody else that might be concerned about that as well. And, of course, it indicates on your website, as you've indicated, of course, you do get some high-profile athletic figures coming through there. You also get a lot of weekend warriors coming through, Eastern Orthopedic Sports Medicine, EOSM.net. So in terms of that, in terms of exercises in general for the public, and again, I know we're talking about a multiplicity of body parts and everything, but what are some good things in general that you recommend? What are some principles to incorporate, regardless of whatever part of the body you're working on, that people should be concerned about as they're trying to keep in good shape and keep from breaking down further?
Sure. The first thing that I try to stress to patients is flexibility. You know, a lot of times we want to get in the gym and we want to grab the weights and push the heaviest weight we can or the most times that we can to tone or to build muscle and strength. But before that, you need flexibility, because one of the reasons we get injured while lifting weights, or we get injured while running, or we get injured by playing tennis, is a lack of flexibility, a lack of pliability of the ligaments and tendons and muscles and the soft tissue structures around our joints. So I really like to focus on flexibility. And the beautiful thing about flexibility is that all you need is, a few feet in an apartment or a bedroom, and you can go through an entire flexibility regimen. The other reason that flexibility is important, and this is outside the realm of traditional sports medicine, but elder sports medicine, meaning my active seniors, is that the difference between falling and having a hip fracture, which we know almost 25% of patients who fall and have a hip fracture are not with us 18 months later. They die for various complications. The difference between falling and sustaining a hip fracture and potentially not falling is the ability to be flexible. which is why, you know, there are in many communities you'll see Tai Chi programs and yoga programs and other sorts of flexibility programs inside senior centers. So flexibility
Absolutely.
Is the thing that I tend to emphasize.
I would guess that does a lot for a lifespan, no question about that, and helping people to stay away from those problematic issues. But again, clearly, Doctor, you have a lot of great advice for people in general and specifically with everything that you practice at Eastern Orthopedic Sports Medicine, EOSM.net. As I anticipated, sir, a true pleasure to have you on the program. Would love to have you back on to talk about some of these matters subsequently, but I thank you so much for your time.
Well, listen, thank you. I really appreciate it. It was a great and fun conversation. It's wonderful to share these things with you and your audience, and be happy to talk to you anytime in the future.
Wonderful, wonderful. We'll take you up on that, sir. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And thank you all, everybody, for tuning in today to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 644.